Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening. Welcome to Interchange. My name is William Morse, and I'm your host tonight. And I'm pleased to have as our guest Maria Eliza Hamilton Bispo de Jesus Abegunde. Or I'm going to call you short during the show, Abegunde. Abegunde is a PhD student in the Department of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Indiana University. She was with us a few months ago, I think before the new year.
Yes.
To speak with us about her activities as a Yoruba priest and the marvelous work she does as a Reiki healer.
Thank you.
We had a great interview the last time, but this time we're going to be talking about something different. And we're going to be talking about a magnificent trip that you took maybe 10 or 12 years ago.
Right, in 1998 and 1999.
And this is going to be a trip that takes us across the Middle Passage.
Exactly.
Can you tell us what the Middle Passage is?
Okay. First, I'd like to thank you for inviting me back to speak. The Middle Passage is what is commonly referred to or defined as that period of voyaging when Africans were taken from Africa, from West and Central Africa, and brought to the Caribbean, South America, to the Americas. So it is a journey that took place in ships, in the hold of ships, anywhere, depending on the end destination, from 60 days upwards to 120 days. So if people could recall scenes in Amistad, for example, of people on ships, that gives you a general idea of what we're talking about.
Slave ships.
Slave ships, yes.
And your trip took place in 1998, 1999. And could you give us an idea of the sort of background of your journey?
First, let me say the name of the project was the Middle Passage Voyage Project. It was captained by Captain William Pinckney, who was from Chicago. And Bill was also one of the first African Americans to ever sail the world solo. So he had completed that journey several years prior to this. Bill had an interest in teaching about the Middle Passage, teaching students and African American communities about the Middle Passage voyage. And he felt that the best way to do that would be through an educational voyage. He put a call out for teachers, as a matter of fact, to participate in this voyage where people would write the curricula for the voyage. It would be centered in South America, the Caribbean, and also Africa. And so I came to the project because I actually taught a poetry workshop, and someone who was partnering with Bill to fund and design the project was in my particular section and called me to ask if I would be interested in working on the curriculum. And so I wanted some more information, and when she told me it would be an opportunity to literally retrace the Middle Passage voyages, the Middle Passage routes of the slave routes, in a backwards fashion to teach, I said, forget about writing. I want to go on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I was working full-time for a school district, so I needed to check with my supervisor and let her know about this project, if I could actually fill out the application with the expectation and hope that I would be accepted to go on the voyage. So that was okay with my job. So we took on my leg. I was the first leg going from Puerto Rico to Brazil. I was the lead team teacher, and I had three classroom teachers with me, Gail, Loretta, and Scott, all of whom were incredibly wonderful. And while I worked in Chicago to design the curricula with the other lead teachers, all of whom were from the Chicago area, they met Bill, the crew, and myself in Puerto Rico when it was time for us to travel.
And how long did the trip last, or how long did the experience last, roughly?
For me, the experience lasted about 2 months from the time that I entered Puerto Rico and the time that I left Brazil. So on any voyage like this, it is not always possible to plan ahead for all of the difficulties that you're going to encounter in nature. And from the beginning, we encountered several difficulties, the ship being damaged, the crew needing to take the time to repair it, spending the time in Puerto Rico more than we had planned so that the work we had scheduled for Brazil ended up having to do in Puerto Rico. And it was really incredible because everyone in San Juan, Luisa, Aldea, everyone was very welcoming. So it was sort of like being on an MTV historical voyage and going to people on the street and saying, hi, we're here on a project from the United States with the Middle Passage Voyage. We're studying slavery. Can you help us? And no one said no. They took us to many wonderful places, opened up their homes and their studios to us. So it was pretty incredible to be able to work that way and to be able to have a team of people who could shift immediately. Knowing that we were going to spend all of our time working in Puerto Rico, since we had all studied Portuguese and not Spanish, it was also another challenge. But we did, I think, a marvelous job. Everything was taped, recorded, and eventually shown as part of different documentaries on Bill. There is an 8-cassette teaching video component. Over 200 schools participated in the project, as well as the Museum of Science and Industry, United States Postal Service, and IBM.
You know, it's interesting to think that these two thoughts. One is that these logistical realities existed probably in the time of the slave ships. There's these logistical problems. Mm-hmm. The ships break down. Crews have to repair them. I mean, so some of this is paralleled in your experience.
Exactly, exactly. And the team, the participating partner with this is IIT in Chicago, also helped us greatly to try to understand, try to prepare. Sherry, who worked for the Institute at the time, did a really very good job in helping us understand what it would take. Bill did not require that we be professional sailors. On my team, only one person had ever sailed before, but he did require a willingness to learn and to learn on the spot how to be a crew member on a ship and how to take care of the duties, how to literally step in whenever anything needed to be done, how to hold watch, how to cook. So it was always a challenge, like every day, to learn how to do something.
What was the longest amount of time that your ship was at sea without going back into port?
The time between Barbados and Brazil. So that was a long time. So at least 2 weeks. We sailed from Puerto Rico to Barbados, where more repairs needed to be made and also to give the crew a break. And then from Barbados down to Brazil.
All right. Well, I think we've got enough background so that our listeners get an idea of where we're getting ready to go now. So we're going to go ahead and start this trip and see if we can recapture some of the great feelings and experiences that you had. And I think you're going to start us off with a poem.
I'm going to start with a poem that I wrote actually after sailing, immediately when I came back for an anthology called Knowing Stones. Keeping Watch, En Route to Brazil, for Captain Bill Pinckney. He tells me about the harness that shackles him to the vessel, its high-quality nylon designed to keep him safe, how the sound like heavy metal against thunder recalls the lost memory of the collar that choked him every time he breathed. I want to tell him that the teak beneath my feet lives even after cutting, how it carries the root stories of oak and pecan, ebony and baobab. For every naked inch of my flesh that touches a plank, I mark my location with grave sites, not longitude. I have known this since birth. I am the last one left because centuries ago the ship which carried 425 of us arrived carrying only me. On nights I dare put one soul on deck, my own voice frightens me as I sing the stories of people whose tongues have been cut, but who insist on speaking. He tells me the voices of children wake him at night. Their laughter surrounds him. Their tiny fingers pat him on the shoulder and rub his balding head. Then he lets the waves carry them where he cannot follow and where I have already gone. They bang themselves against the hull of my bunk until I am bruised by their urging that I am the vessel being carried. I want to tell him about the screaming inside my head since Barbados. Sister, they say, I have left my story here, under your armpit, in your left eye, in your womb. Remember, memory is your gift to us. Remember the chains that bind us, make us whole. He tells me softly, you've not had the benefit of night watch when the ancestors walk above deck. I laugh quietly, and I want to tell him it is not only above deck that we walk, but I am silent. One day we will speak of the things that haunt us.
That is a great articulation of your journey through the past and the present. It's interesting how the poem ends on a night watch, as if it's a bit of a reminder to you to keep watch over all the memories and things that you've been given on this journey.
Exactly. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and take a look at the journal that you started and that you wrote during this trip.
Yes. During the trip, and actually before the trip, I kept the journal. I've actually been keeping a journal all of my life. This was a really interesting opportunity to document my process from packing. I was moving out of my house at the time in Evanston, Illinois, living in a room with all of my things. And I began documenting in the very early part, all of my things, how many boxes I had, how many boxes of toothpaste I had, really a ship's manifest, my house's manifest, and thinking about what it was like perhaps to load a ship. Not counting the human beings that were being brought on, but just the practical things, and started to live in a very closed space just to get a better idea. So I'm going to read various segments from different times in the journal. I'm going to begin with January 7th in Puerto Rico, 1999. We had moved to the marina at this time because we realized that we were not going to be able to leave directly. And so it's very interesting living in a marina for a while if you're not a sailor, and where you bathe, all of the things that you do. So 7th of January, 1999, Thursday, San Juan Marina. Took a shower, but I don't think I'll feel clean until I'm on land again. Amongst ourselves, we've been discussing how we feel. I am sleeping with my luggage because I don't have enough space for things. I keep thinking about what Africans did, those who had religious taboos, those who had ancestors they couldn't bring with them. I'm thinking how difficult it is for me to not carry my things, emotional and material. For them, it wasn't even about taking one thing only. It was about taking nothing, sometimes not even the skin on their backs. How we came to such lands carrying what we knew in our heads after such horror and nearly losing our minds. How long did it take us to remember what we knew once we were able to push the fear a little behind us? That is my way of working, isn't it? How would I pray if I had no access to the rituals and implements that I normally used? Ifa survived because Africans adjusted, changed, made it adapt. We made do. We created things from nothing and sometimes a lot of blood.
As we read through these, your journal entries and your poetry, I begin to get the idea that you are almost starting to channel the experiences of slaves who went across the Middle Passage hundreds of years ago through this experience that you had?
I would say at this particular point, no. As later, as we go on, because I think when you've been out on water for so long, someone once told me that when you are sailing, when you are out on water for so long, that you need to believe in something. Because we went through periods, particularly when we left Barbados, where we saw no other ships, where we saw no other human beings. And so at this point, I'm just allowing myself the opportunity to record what it is that I'm feeling at this particular time.
And as you read that last part, you made references to what the slaves could not bring with them and the difficulty of all that they had to leave behind. It sounds as if something is starting to take shape in your observational powers or feelings at this point?
Well, I think at this point, because I have been studying slavery, in particular aspect of slavery, the Middle Passage and memory and violence for a long time related to this, it moves from the academic to the practical in a very different way. And I remember doing an interview with Brian Cox of the Chicago Tribune, and one of the questions he asked was, well, whether or not our ship was going to be outfitted like a slave ship. And I said, no, it's not go. We're not going to be in chains. But I had specifically spoken with my team members about doing work, imagining themselves. And not all of us were African American as part of the team. So it was really important that we be able to imagine ourselves to actually choose the life of a possible slave and to envision what that life might have been. What would we have done? And so we had several discussions about this. Once we did meet up, what might it have been like for us to be in that position? Because teaching students is one thing, but you have to be able to bring your students into that place with you for them to really understand the full magnitude of what it is like to be 600 people in a space constructed for not even 200 or 300 people.
You mentioned in your reading that you just did that the Africans adjusted, that they changed, that they made it adapt. Is that part of what you're expressing here in this beginning? Because I sense that there's always this adjustments to smaller spaces, this reorientation or disorientation, all that's going to take place as you prepare to go into something that you have not done before.
Yes. Disorientation being the perfect word for that. Stephanie Smallwood talks about that in Saltwater Slavery. And recently, I've been reading a book by James Noel on imagination and matter. And I think part of what he talks about is the necessity and the ability for people who were in slave ships to simultaneously die and reborn to create themselves, right? So adjustment doesn't even begin to talk about that. Is how do you as a person, as a people, as a group of people, as a community, formed or not formed yet in this situation, how do you come to terms that the existence you knew, the self that you knew, is very slowly being eradicated and that you are forced, if you are going to live, to become something else at that time in order to survive.
And it's interesting, with your experience here in Puerto Rico, you can make a determination about what you can bring and what you can't bring, using your words. But of course, when we go back and as you go deeper into the Middle Passage experience, it becomes of what you brought and what you couldn't bring.
Precisely. I think this is the question also, you know, bringing it into more contemporary format for immigrants, for refugees, that same type of question. You don't bring anything with you. And so it forced me also to think about how much I, as a person, collected.
I'm here with Abagunde. My name is William Morse, and you're with Interchange. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. This is Interchange. My name is William Morris. I'm here tonight with Abegunde, and we're talking about her trip along the Middle Passage. Abegunde, during the break, we were talking a little bit about that first entry you made on January 7th, 1999, and about this whole idea of getting ready to go out on a long journey across water and the disorientation, the things, the idea that you can't bring everything, that you have to decide what you can bring and what you can't bring. And you mentioned to me a terrific exercise that a colleague of yours shared with you.
Right. This colleague, one of the things that she was teaching was about refugees and what refugees are able to bring and not bring with them. And she had us fill out three index cards. The first one was the name of a family member with whom we'd like to travel, someone dear to us. So, of course, that would be your spouse, your mother, your child. The second was with something that, to write down something that we really liked that was a favorite of us, you know, a book or that we wanted to take. And the third, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was along those veins as well. And so afterwards, she collected all of our index cards and she tore them up. And she said, this is what refugees are able to bring with them when they leave home. And it was a very powerful, powerful exercise because, of course, the thing that we have to understand is that Africans who were enslaved and brought a slave were not ever given a choice where to go, what to bring, how to consider. Even you may have been walking on your way home and may have been captured and enslaved. So there were not any choices, right? So that has to be made. But it's still a very powerful thing to understand. And one of the things that the trip did for me in collecting, because I pack for what if, you know, what if it rains on this day? What if I run out of honey? What if I meet this person? And we overpacked. I definitely overpacked, I think, more than anyone. But we tried to find that place. But it made me think about what it is that I collect and what it is that I should make myself live without, and what I could live without, and what I thought I could not live without. Because the end of the story is, by the time that trip was over, I had not used probably 95% of what I had brought with me for a number of reasons. And so I'm always conscious of that now. So it was a very, very powerful experience. If you'd like, I'll continue.
Yes, I would. There's one comment I wanted to make. It's interesting when you talk about a slave, for example, who might have been on his or her way home, and all of a sudden they're captured and just taken into slavery. And we think about this is like sudden death. I mean, it's like you're suddenly dead in one way, because that to which you're accustomed to, you don't go back. You're separated from that.
Right. And at the time, it's more than likely that you don't really realize the situation that you are in, right? That you perhaps still have a hope that someone will come for you or that someone will find you. So you don't really know. And I'm basing this on, you know, recent works that I've been reading and scholarship that I'm reading right now in reimaginings sort of just thinking, or even, for example, we were talking earlier about the writings of Equiano from the middle 18th century, right? 1789, did we say?
Mm-hmm.
And so just thinking about that writing and what it was like to record that, his being one of the accounts, one of the only accounts that we have, or early accounts that we have, of someone, an African male, who survived the Middle Passage and what that was like. And so Equiano himself went on to become a great abolitionist. His work helped and continues to help us understand part of that transition, but what it was like for someone if he came from a different kind of family, a chief's family, someone who learned how to speak English, someone who used his skills and his experience to fight slavery, to fight the system at that time. But he talks, writes about in that, in his journals and his travels, about the fear that he had, about not knowing what was going to happen to him, if he was going to be eaten, where people were going to be taken, what kind of work they were going to be doing. It's all important to know that, because nowadays we move so easily between places and spaces, and we don't often give ourselves time to think about the type of disorientation that we experience when even when we travel from city to city. But it does happen.
And just for the sake of for the benefit of our listeners, Equiano was, as we talked about, the first African to really sort of autobiographically write about his experiences through the Middle Passage. And I think, as we said, that occurred in 1789 or 1780s. Right. And that, of course, the Middle Passage experience had been going on for 250 years at the time he wrote it.
Right.
So it was an old, used, long-used commercial route by that time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a lot of scholarship. I work in one particular area from my area of interest in terms of memory and in terms of the type of violence that produces what we now know to be trauma. But there are many very good documents and scholarly documents for anyone who might be interested in the roots themselves, in the construction of slave ships, the development of industries around the slave industry in Liverpool and other areas. So there are a number of good books. Hugh Thomas's Slave Ship is one. There is a book called The Diligent, which traces the journey of a slave ship. There is Stephanie Smallwood, The Saltwater Slavery. So those are three books that I can think of off the top of my head that speak about this experience now that we are learning more and more about every day.
We started on January 7th, 1999, with the first day of your journal that you're sharing with us here. Let's go on from that time.
I'm going to move to January 24th, when we've actually starting to move towards Brazil, and we are at sea now. I vomited a little bile this morning when we first started. I slept the entire trip, waking up intermittently to see the water and landscape. While I was sleeping, I could feel the ancestors pull on me, and one particular story stays with me. The image. One woman jumping overboard with her baby. She went to the bottom, started walking, and then came up. The baby died. The mother kept floating, willing herself to die. But she kept saying over and over, "It's so hard to drown, so hard to drown. I have no fear, that is why. I cannot drown because I have no fear of drowning or dying. My baby was afraid, but I am not. I want to die, but how can I die when I have no fear? Perhaps I should fear living more, and then that will take me to the bottom. Perhaps I should think of the horror of living instead." M came to check on me several times and to make sure I had water and food. I drifted in and out.
Big change has occurred from the first day when you were trying to figure out what to bring and what not to bring.
Exactly.
Can you take us deeper a little bit into that?
Well, I think by this time there's a just the process of traveling on water. And I think as I read more that you'll get a sense of what it's like to be there. I think that I'd like to do that because
yes.
It's better to read. So January 27th, Wednesday. I have been using a tape recorder the last few days because writing while sailing is difficult. I am not certain I'm going to make the rest of the journey to Brazil if every moment of my day and night will be filled with images, voices, memories I can't shut out. I am thinking of going home in Barbados. Dream. My friend G came to me in white and laid across my sheets to let me know I would be all right. I need that reassurance now. Sleeping in my bunk is disconcerting, disturbing. So much water. I've developed this fear of water seeping through the walls. What if I wake up and the water is coming in? What if there is a leak? What if I drown? So all night long, water. I am sleeping in my clothes, my shoes, and glasses every night since leaving Puerto Rico. I am afraid to be naked or to be caught with nothing on in case something happens. This morning, I completely washed off my body. The most I can usually manage is to brush my teeth and wash my face.
You used the words disconcerting, disturbing. We started out disorientation.
It sort of unravels from a point. My assignment on the ship, Bill gave each of us assignments, was to know where the food was, the little packets of food, I forget what you call them now, was in case there was an emergency.
And rations?
The rations were where they were. So I knew where that was. And I developed such an anxiousness that I actually slept in the captain's area at the wheel. So Bill would be on deck, I would sleep. He said he had never seen anyone sleep like this on a little plank. And I just held on because I didn't like sleeping in my bunk. But I also felt like I wanted to be with him. So if he at 2 a.m. in the morning said, well, Eliza, where are we? I could look at the instruments and say, well, we're here. And so I did this because in the back of my mind, I kept feeling, oh, my gosh, what if something happens to us? So it begins to unravel a little bit for me because, you realize you can't use water as you had. You have to, once you leave port, you have to be very mindful about what you cook, how you use water, what you're doing. And so we encountered several problems. And so I like to tell people that by the time I got to Brazil, by the time I got to Fortaleza, I had not bathed in at least 17 days. I had not changed my clothes. I had not done anything. One, because I was so exhausted. For me, learning how to walk on a ship that is moving that way and where waves are constantly picking you up and twisting and turning, it became very painful. And, you know, at some point we laughed when we had first left Puerto Rico, the Coast Guard ship came by to look at us because we were just kind of laid out on the deck. We were all sick. We couldn't move. But the further I went along, it became just difficult because your body has to adjust. And I had sustained several injuries as well in my hip and in my shoulder, but primarily in my hip, which had made it difficult to walk. So some days, you get up, you do what you have to do, you plan your lesson, you address the students. But when you get up and you look out, there's nothing but water. And you do get disoriented. So the thing that, to think about was how was it that Africans may have felt not even having opportunities on a regular basis to see light, to be in such close, hot, horrible, unsanitary conditions. So none of us were complaining. Complaining was not allowed. But you still had to acknowledge how you were feeling at this particular time in the work that you were doing and the importance of the voyage and trying at least just for a very small inkling to imagine what it might have been like for one of our ancestors to have made this voyage.
I like what you wrote, one line that you had here. I'm wondering if every moment of my day and night will be filled with images, voices, and memories that I can't shut out. What was starting to come to you at that time?
Well, one of the things was the image that I had of that woman, and also the thing that
the woman with the baby.
The woman with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then the poem makes reference to something that Bill said to me about not having the benefit of holding night watch when the ancestors walk above deck.
Let's hear that again, maybe.
And he tells me softly, "You've not had the benefit of night watch when the ancestors walk above deck." I laugh quietly and want to tell him it is not only above deck that we walk, but I am silent. One day we will speak of the things that haunt us. So there were a lot of things. If I was in my bunk for long periods of time, it was just listening to the water and listening. As I said, that I began to mark our journey by grave sites, unmarked grave sites instead of longitude and latitude, right? And so these sorts of things began to enter my head, to feel them, to have a better understanding of what and who actually we were traveling on top of as we were going towards Brazil.
Well, I am. I'm moved by this idea of voices. Are these voices that you feel, voices that would speak to you in a dream, voices that would come in your sleep.
All of the above.
And more.
And more.
Let's move on from January 27th to...
Let's go to February 10th.
Okay.
Okay. We are several hundred miles from the mouth of the Amazon, humid and hazy. I have to write in pencil because the pens have stopped working. Everyone is complaining about something, the water, the refrigerator, the heat, unable to distinguish the horizon from anything else. In Barbados, saw the sun turn green as it set. I should spend more time taking pictures. Here I want to say that when we got to Barbados and at the end of our time in Barbados, the teaching crew, all of whom were classroom teachers, needed to go back. And because I was not a classroom teacher, I was working at the administrative level, I actually opted to stay for the rest of the journey.
So this this entry, we have arrived in Barbados.
In this entry, we have left Barbados. So we
on
are
the way
sailing
to Brazil.
Right. So we are again sailing, yeah.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, there's sort of like two legs of this journey. Is that correct? There's Puerto Rico to Barbados, and then Barbados to Brazil.
Right, exactly. That's how we ended up traveling.
Do we have time? I think we have time for one more entry, if you want to share one more with us.
Okay, I'll start this entry at February 11th. I am ready to go home. No epiphanies, no defining spiritual moment. Tired of the constant noise around me, even when no one is talking. The ocean knocks against the bow as if we are a toy. In the face of a 30-foot wave, I can only hang on. The captain laughs at me as I scamper across the deck on my butt, but I am too afraid of being taken over. Sleepless nights, souls which have followed us are talking and breathing louder so that between waves I hear their whispers. I crawl into my bunk like I am dead. I do not know which I fear most, the long days of avoiding the voices or the nights of being in this coffin. I want to put my feet on solid ground again. I want to feel the earth meet me halfway. Yet I know the moment my feet touch land and lead away from here that I am a stranger to everyone, especially myself.
This is Interchange. My name is William Morris, and I'm here with Abogunde, sharing with us her notes and memories and journal entries from her voyage across the Middle Passage. We'll be back with more. Welcome back to Interchange. My name is William Morris, and I'm here this evening with Abogunde. And we have been having a fascinating journey across the one leg of the Middle Passage, going from Puerto Rico to Barbados to on to Brazil. Abagunde, before we go back to the journey and your time on the Middle Passage, let's talk a little bit about a symposium that's coming up very soon that has to do with issues that we're talking about today and other issues of the African diaspora, I think.
Yes, I would like to invite everyone to the 8th Annual Herman C. Hudson Symposium. It is called Black is Black Ain't, Reconceptualizing the African Diaspora. It will be held on Saturday, March 26th from 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Registration will begin at 7:45 a.m., and it will be held at the Neil Marshall Black Culture Center. Our keynote speaker this year is going to be Professor Michelle Wallace, author of Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman, and daughter of African-American quilter Faith Ringgold. And Professor Wallace will be speaking about her mother's work during the symposium, during the keynote. So this is a symposium that is sponsored by the Graduate Society of the Department of African-American and African Diaspora Studies, to honor the memory of Herman C. Hudson, who was the department's founder.
And if you want to go, Abagunde will be there. So if you have any other questions about what we're talking about tonight, they could probably find you there.
Yes, and also they could check the department's website for more information. But it is a free symposium, so there's no registration fee. A brunch will be served. So there's no fee for that as well. So, and it is open to the public, to the IU community.
Let's go on back to your journal. And I think we left off somewhere around February 11th. And, you know, during the break, you and I discussed this thing. And the more I keep listening to you and the more we read your journal, and as you're crossing the Caribbean Sea, going out a little bit into the Atlantic, there's these voices that keep coming back to you. And you've promised us we're going to get your commentary on that, but we're going to keep reading a little bit more first. Is that right?
We will. I've promised you that we'll get back to that. The other thing I just want to say is that this was a project, the Middle Passage Voyage Project, was designed to be a backwards revisiting of the Middle Passage routes in order to start at some points of entry, beginning in the Caribbean, the United States, and going back to the continent. So after my leg, there were several other legs that picked up in Bahia, who went to Ghana and Senegal, and then came back full to Puerto Rico. So this was only one of several legs, but the intent was to help people see the routes. And we talked about corporate involvement with this, the development of industry around the slave trade. So it was partially as we entered ports to actually see areas where sugarcane was important, for example, where tobacco was important, rice was important, how these types of industries, how this agriculture impacted the slave trade. So it was very good for students as well as the cultural aspect and knowing who revolutionaries were, what types of arts developed. So very multi-level and multi-purpose what Bill Pinckney had envisioned.
You know, we talked a little bit about this, and I'm not trying to show off my own knowledge, but we've been, you know, and if you go into this discussion of the African diaspora, you have to go into this emergence and growth of the sugar industry and how slavery really fueled the sugar industry. And one of the things I was reading recently is that how, I'm not sure exactly how they compiled this data, but somewhere around the early 1700s, the average person in England consumes about 4 pounds of sugar a year. And going into the 20th century, an average person in England consumes 120 pounds of sugar a year. And this is attached to me. The roots of that industry are firmly planted in slavery.
Yeah, it's a lot. The more I know for myself, the more that I learn, the less that I know, because so much information becomes available over 5 years or 10 years as we look at things from very different perspectives. And one of the challenges is when you're looking at a topic from one particular area perspective and you start branching out, you really realize where there are more connections to be made and how much you know. So it's always of interest to me, lots of things, because it is. The more I read, the more I see, the more I know, the less I know. And so I like that because it means that I'm always learning and I'm opening to revisioning how we imagine things to be and how our identities, the conference actually, the symposium will speak to that, like how we envision our identities, how we think we are, and how we came to be. We make certain assumptions without taking a lot of things into consideration and the impact. And again, I'm going back to James Nowell and actually Charles Long. I'm reading also the ways in which this particular system, this particular slavery and the transatlantic slave trade brought people into contact with one another for some expected and unexpected results. So it's a very profound type of movement that happened.
Are we ready to go back to the journal?
We are. I am going to continue where I left off. I am grateful to the captain for not insisting I hold watch, not that I am not interested. I watch him closely. I asked many questions. I need to know where things are, how they work, just in case. But a day or two out of Barbados, I stopped, a warning from a dream. I am terrified of drowning, of being pulled over the side. The old ones talk to me in the daytimes. They come, put their hands on me, and journey with me. Longitude and latitude have no meaning. I understand now that the world turns on a sound. Find the right wavelength, the right tone, and we will all be filled with ecstasy or madness. The old Africans say that some of them drowned at the bottom of the hold, that some of them let the others climb on top so they could get air. February 13, 1999, crossed the equator. February 19, 1999. Having fun with my limited Portuguese, everyone has been helpful. I arranged a cab from the yacht club and found out about customs and other things not in the guidebook. It helps that your name is the same as someone's mother. So at February 19th, we had, by that time, docked in Fortaleza, and we were trying to get me home as the last teaching member of the crew. And because we had all, like I said, studied Spanish and not Portuguese, my Portuguese was very limited at the time. So I discovered that if I said my name was Maria, which is the name of many people, their mothers, their sisters, it became very easy for me to have a conversation. People said, ah, Maria, come, let me show you. And so this is actually the last entry from the voyage itself in the journal. But I found as I was writing this that I needed to return to another segment, an earlier segment from February 11th. That is actually, in fact, the ending of this particular manuscript. So I'll read that, and that will perhaps get to more of your interest in the voices. So returning to February 11th. The ancestors say, tell the stories. All over the world, people have told their atrocities and have made good fortune from them. No one will tell because there are no living witnesses. We make you and your sisters and brothers living witnesses. We will come when you call. As time goes by, you will know our names, our stations, our countries, our languages. You will begin your telling with the horrors, the screaming that is racking you now, and you will shape it into language so beautiful all who hear it will cry. You will pass the barrier of thought and sound, and your gift will be to leave them in the bowels of the ship and then to bring them home. Tell them Arroyo sent you.
As you read this, I'm thinking to myself, the ebb and flow of the ocean and the ebb and flow of history, that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And mm-hmm. even as there were none to tell our history at that particular time, our history is being told now with the help of people like you.
Absolutely. And even then, there at this particular time, there are no living witnesses, although there are several books that I've recently seen and that I have whose names I can't recall at the moment, who have gone in search of descendants of slaves. And there's a current conversation going on one of the academic listservs about this. And so There are people who have histories, and there are people who told stories. Obviously, Alex Haley's Roots, right? So there are stories. It's that sometimes the stories have not made it into the public view. Sometimes they're part of a family history that does not get included in a larger a national or community conversation in terms of history, but we all have that. People remember, I have heard stories from friends whose families passed down stories of people who were slaves, who were free, who created communities. So there are different types of stories to be told. So I think that I'm only telling one part of that story, and some of that is the story of the people who did not live. And so when you talk about the voices, it's part of other processes in terms of healing, in terms of imagining, in terms of allowing oneself to be a vessel. And this particular entry from February 11th that ends gets into what's a very liminal space in any kind of conversation. I actually remember writing this and writing it without really being conscious of what I was writing, just writing, not looking at the page, not looking at anything. And how I knew that it was a part of a channeled experience, in fact, was that when I went back to the document, this is not the full text of it, there were words written in other languages. And when I got home, I had to find people to translate what I had written to me in order to understand it.
Were you able to find?
I did. Some of it was in Portuguese, which at the time I did not have at all. So I had to find someone to explain things to me and just other pieces. So I was able to do that.
This entry from February 11th, the ancestors say, tell the stories. All over the world, people have told their atrocities. We make you and your sisters and brothers living witnesses. We will come when you call. This is almost a charge.
Exactly.
And it's a charge to others through you at this time on February 11th. Are there other things you remember about this charge, these voices, the ancestors, the old ones, the old Africans? You mentioned them again and again and again. And I guess I'm asking something that I guess in my mind is so obvious that maybe I'm scared to ask the question, but who are they?
Who are the ancestors who are the people speaking to me?
Or? Yes.
Well, for me at the time, as I was writing it and as I've gone back to the manuscript, I know when they say tell them Arroyo sent you, you can have a group of people. So a group of people who have died in this particular case, who are needing their stories to be told. And some of them, which I can't get into, have identified. So, you know, their names that I have, which at some point I will get to checking locations, even the slave ship. So part of the reason why the unmarked grave sites as opposed to longitude and latitude became very important to me and still is important is because, again, I think, you know, many people have probably seen Spielberg's Amistad, is to understand how oftentimes slaves were thrown overboard, whether they were sick or they needed to be thrown overboard for insurance purposes, any number of things. So it's their bones of people there or the remnants of people there. And so these are the people who are speaking.
And so the estimate is, and I don't know, I guess there's no exact way of knowing, of course, but the estimate is that one-tenth of the slaves that were – one-tenth of the Africans who were taken from the continent did not make it to the New World.
There are varying estimates, and I don't have a most current number on that.
But the point being that this graveyard in the ocean is a large one.
It's a large one. I'm thinking if people wanted to investigate the case of the Zong, I believe the ship was called, in the 1700s, where 130 Africans were thrown overboard. So there are and there that number, it varies in different documents that I've seen, but there are many things that I was thinking of at that particular time. But for me, in this particular case, it is those people who did not make it, who were there, who were like literally traveling, you know. So when Bill said, you know, I'm not doing night watch, and so I don't get to hear or see the ancestors walk, you know, we had talked about who I was coming aboard the ship and what that meant when we got to Puerto Rico as a person at the time I was being initiated. And so what that meant in terms of the spiritual component coming to the ship, to add a different element to that and to keep these things in mind as we were journeying.
Would you like to do this again?
I would. As a matter of fact, at the end of the journey, I said to him, man, had I known, I would have signed, I would have left my job and I would have sailed all the way with you. And he said, yes, but you'd have to change your ways. I said, I know, I'd have to keep watch. Because I just, at that time, I had had a really bad dream about literally being pulled over. I said, yeah, I know, I'd hold watch. But I thought, yeah, I would. I would learn how to sail, you know, even more, because he's a master sailor and there was so much to learn. So yes, actually.
Does Captain Bill Pinckney still do these trips?
He, a few years ago, captained the Amistad, the replica of the Amistad. He actually took it from port to port as a teaching vessel throughout the United States. And he traveled with the Amistad when it did its voyage from here to Sierra Leone, in fact. So I'm not quite sure how retired he is now, but still loves his work.
Oh, I'm sure. My name is William Morris, and you've been with us for 1 hour sharing some of the experiences of the Middle Passage with Abogunde. Abogunde, it's been great having you with us. Gosh, there's so much more that we could talk about on this subject. You want to just tell us one more time a little bit about the symposium that's coming up on the 26th?
Yes, just again, the 8th Annual Herman C. Hudson Symposium, Black Is, Black Ain't, Reconceptualizing the African Diaspora. That'll be on March 26th, Saturday, March 26th, 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Neil Marshall Black Culture Center. So everyone is welcome. There's no registration fee. Our keynote speaker is Professor Michelle Wallace, and the keynote will be given as part of a brunch.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I hope you all can make it to the symposium. And thank you for being with us today on Interchange. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morse. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. And stay tuned for Stardust with Brother Tillman coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.